And I'm Thorne Dreyer, and you got Rag Radio here. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, how are you doing today, sir?
Doing well. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Roger Baker is here taking pictures. Greg Ciotti is here. We got a great, we always have such a wonderful crew. I want to remind everybody that we're syndicated. Rag Radio originates on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin, Texas. It's a cooperatively run all-volunteer community radio station. It's very unique in that sense. We're rebroadcast on several other community stations around the country, and our podcasts go all over the place. So we have, I guess they say, the show has some legs. So maybe not as many as we might like, but actually we're very happy with it. And we hear back a whole lot from people listening in all kinds of places. I was at a conference and just this past weekend, and I met somebody who said, "Oh, I listened to your show in Knoxville." So, hey, you guys nice. In Knoxville.
Nice.
Nice, yeah. Beautiful weather. Just lovely, although it's going to get real cold this weekend here in Austin. So. Michael Hawinski.
Yes.
Here, present, is the curator of the O. Henry Museum, the historical home of the short story writer William Sidney Porter, which is located in Austin. Michael edited and wrote the afterword for As Others See Us, a lost O. Henry manuscript made into a fine press limited edition book. Michael premiered the book at the 20th Annual Texas Book Festival, where he was a guest speaker. Michael is also a freelance journalist and has writes for the New York Times, Texas Monthly, and other publications. Ben Sargent, who illustrated As Others See Us, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist whose editorial cartoons appeared in the Austin American Statesman from 1974 to 2014 and were distributed nationally by Universal Press Syndicate. Sargent is staff cartoonist at the Texas Observer, and his Lone Star State has run there since 2009. Ben, who won the 1982 Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning and was a finalist in 2001 and 2002, is also an active letterpress printer and was involved in the printing of As Others See Us. And he's continuing a grand tradition of fine printing. I have to say, I saw both of these. This whole thing came together because I went to a panel at the Texas Book Festival where these gentlemen were presenting about the lost manuscript, O. Henry's lost manuscript, which they have been involved in turning into a simply gorgeous book. And there are some, and it was just, it was enthralling. They could have gone on for hours because there's so many different aspects to this story. And it includes O. Henry, who is a remarkable character himself. And I looked up the Wikipedia page, which is, I think, woefully inadequate, actually. But 2/3 of it is about his time in Austin. He was in Austin and in Houston for an extended period of time. There's the way the book was put together, how it gets verified, authenticated, all the different aspects of it are pretty astounding. So I think we're going to have a fun show here. I do want to ask Ben Sargent something before we even get started. Do you feel no guilt? Do you have no shame? for being this acclaimed Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist with the incredible cast of characters you've got here in Texas politics. I'm kidding, but
it is sort of astounding, and the astounding cast of characters on the national stage as
too,
well.
Yeah.
In a way, I guess I'm glad I'm not doing a daily cartoon, because how would you satirize some of the stuff that's going on? I mean, it just...
and that's really been true in a lot of ways in Texas politics over the years, but right now it's virtually everything on the national stage. Mm-hmm. It's cartoon like.
Yeah, it's sort of difficult to make a parody of it.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, Michael has a wonderful afterword in this book. This book is this beautiful print. I mean, it's high tech, beautiful traditional printing. And it has these beautiful illustrations by Ben Sargent, which I said when I went to the panel, I think I mentioned that they also seem totally appropriate to the period. And I noticed in the afterward that, you know, that Mike, you referred to the fact that that could have almost been done by O. Henry in his early work with, what, Rolling Stone? Or his,
yeah, I mean, we
not the Rolling Stone that you folks out there know, but...
Correct. So. Two separate Rolling Stones. This right. Rolling Stone predates the Rolling Stone that we know. This is the Rolling Stone newspaper that O. Henry, whose real name is William Sidney Porter, he published it for about a year when he lived here in Austin, and we like to refer to it sort of as a precursor to The Onion. It was satirical in nature, poked fun at politicians, probably kind of was in... predecessor to what the line of work Ben did, really, drawing satirical editorial cartoons, wrote a lot of the stories for the book, self-published it, had an office down in San Antonio that he did a lot of distribution through. So, yeah.
He, I think O. Henry, which is the primary nom de plume that he used, was perhaps our most accomplished, our most famed writer of short fiction in this country, would you say? I mean,
yeah. I mean, he's had an annual anthology called the O. Henry Prize Stories, you know, named after him, and the best stories from around the world are chosen each year and put into that book, and that is a collection that's actually edited by a woman named Laura Furman, who's a professor here at University of Texas.
Right. So. I remember, I think The Ransom of Red Chief was the first thing I ever read by him. And, you know, the Gift of the Magi is maybe his most famous. I don't know.
Yeah, those are two really, really good stories to tell people. You know, Henry was known for his twist endings. So Gifts of the Magi, which you've probably all read in school at some point, about a poor couple who want to buy each other Christmas presents. The woman has this long, beautiful hair that she cuts and sells to buy her husband a fob for his pocket watch. Meanwhile, he sells his pocket watch to buy her these combs that she's been coveting for the hair that was just cut. And similarly, The Ransom of Red Chief is about these con men who've got this brilliant idea to abduct this kid and hold him for ransom. Well, he turned out to be a little S-H-I-T, and they end up having to pay the parents to take the kids back. So that's O. Henry's humor. Wrote, you know, 350 stories that we know of, and this the twist ending was a signature of his.
Yeah, so if you want to look for a synonym for irony, go to O. Henry. Al Reinert and I had written, and this is another thing I mentioned at the event, Al Reinert had written we had written an article in Texas Monthly back in, when was it, 1973, April of 1973, talking about the mantras. That it was called Montrose Lives, There's Something for Everyone in Houston's Montrose, The Strangest Neighborhood East of the Pecos, which was not actually my headline. That was the Monthly's headline. But we said, from the days when O. Henry worked for the Houston Post and peddled short stories on the side, Montrose has nourished Houston's creativity. And he spent a lot of time in Austin and had a band.
He had a band.
I mean, just like every writer in Austin, everybody in Austin, anybody who has to also be a musician on the side, dang it. Except me, because I can't carry a tune.
He was a Renaissance guy, really. An exceptional short story writer, obviously. An illustrator. When he worked in his uncle's pharmacy in North Carolina before moving to Texas, he was known to draw all of the regular customers and was encouraged to go to art school, but chose not to pursue that. And, you know, he was an exceptional musician. had a quartet here in town called the Hill City Quartet. He played a lot of stringed instruments, mandolin, guitar, probably banjo. We've at the museum actually had a local musician named Howard Raines, a fiddler here in Austin, put together a quartet to sort of replicate some of the old-time parlor songs that band might have performed, and that was part of a exhibit we had a couple years ago called O. Henry Original Slacker. So playing off your idea that everyone here is a musician.
it's astounding. And I think it was actually, I saw something, it was in the Wikipedia article where it said that he developed his writing and sort of started getting really known for his writing when he was working at the Houston Post.
Yeah, I think he did a little bit of kind of some society writing, actually, when he was with the Post. He sort of his sort of through line was he went from North Carolina to Cotulla, Texas, down by San Antonio was his first entry point into Texas, and was a sheep herder on a ranch there, Dole Ranch, that was run by some former Texas Rangers, and then he made his way to Austin and then Houston and to the federal penitentiary, and then off to New York.
When he worked in a bank in Austin, there was some question of embezzlement, I believe.
There was. He was brought up on charges twice, found not guilty the first time, obviously found guilty the second time. But it turned out to be a pretty good deal for him, because in prison he was free of the daily rigors and financial constraints, and actually had a chance to write some stories that he had success publishing once he got out and moved to New York City, and the rest is sort of history.
It's this article said that when he moved to Houston, we're talking 1895, folks. He started writing for the Post. His salary was only $25 a month, but it rose steadily as his popularity increased. It says, Porter gathered ideas for his column by loitering in hotel lobbies and observing and talking to people. So this was a technique he used throughout his writing career. So,
yeah, I mean, I think he fictionalized the people he saw day in and day out, especially when he was in New York, and he's so well known as a chronicler of that city, and that's what makes the story of O. Henry Museum in Austin so interesting, is that a lot of people don't know that this was his sort of starting point and where he really began as a writer.
And the museum is in his former home.
Correct. It's a historical home, a national literary landmark that's run by the City of Austin Parks and Rec Department. It's free Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 5. He rented the house with his wife and daughter for a couple years in the 1890s, five or so years later, he was in prison, and his wife had passed, and his daughter went into the custody of his wife's mother and stepfather and moved to Pittsburgh.
And by the way, I mean, Ben, please feel free to pop in on anywhere along in here, and we will talk about the art, and we will talk about the, and I want you to really talk about how this beautiful book was put together too, and it's, you know, it's interesting for anyone who has an interest in fine printing and the history of printing and typefaces and stuff. It was amazing the way it was done. So why don't you give us a little bit of info, give us a little history, Mike, about the way the book came about.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I've been at the museum for maybe about 7 years, and the former curator of the museum, who has since retired, her name is Valerie Bennett, and she squirreled away money into her discretionary fund over the years and was finally able to purchase a set of manuscripts from a company out of New Haven, Connecticut called William Reese, a rare books dealer. They got these manuscripts at auction, a private auction, so we don't know the exact provenance, but these short stories became available to her. And, you know, I think people are always kind of intrigued when they hear about kind of masters, lost works, and you've rediscovered something. So,
and you wonder, well, was it something that they didn't want printed? You know, was it something that
didn't consider?
Exactly. Or was it something that they were saving for, you know, whatever? That you don't know what that means necessarily.
Sure. And one day, you know, before she was leaving, she kind of opened up the treasure chest to me and showed me these stories, and I pretty excited. I thought I had a real big discovery, and I poured through the stories, and this one out of the five really just jumped out at me. It was the most complete of all of them, and it was different than a lot of O. Henry stories that I'd read, because it was pretty dark. And the more research I did into it and O. Henry's story, I found it to be sort of maybe an autobiographical story that perhaps left William Sidney Porter, who we know as O. Henry, a little vulnerable, and that is perhaps why he chose a different byline for this story, Del Oliver. When we displayed this book last year for an exhibit, we did some research and found that O. Henry was just one of a couple pen names that Porter used. It was the predominant pen name, but we found other instances. So this wasn't out of character for him. And so as Valerie is assessing whether to buy these, we have one of her friends, Dr. Jenny Lynn Porter, who lives here in Austin, is a cousin many generations removed from William Sidney Porter. She's a former Texas poet laureate in her own right, a literary scholar. She helped vet these manuscripts, and they're handwritten manuscripts. So there's a lot of things that you can look at to authenticate them. And as someone who's read a lot of stories, you just kind of get that feeling.
So. Even though this one kind of broke from a lot of his tradition and it didn't have that ironic twist necessarily. I love it. This guy is sort of a secret drunk who prides himself on the fact that he is able to basically, you know, be this distinguished gentleman, portly, to be sure, and not show that. I mean, he knows exactly how much to drink without, you know, but he's always drunk to his life. And then he said that there's this one scene where he goes into a bookstore, and this was when he started getting worried because he said that he said that it's always the tongue. That's the organ that you have to worry the most about. Everything else he was able to give. And so he asked them if they had this book, and I don't remember what the book was.
Theophrastus Such, which is...
Is it a real George Eliot book?
Yes, it is.
It was a George Eliot book, and they thought he said, and they brought him a copy of Swiss Family Robinson. And he said, luckily, at least what he said sounded sort of like something. And so he said he was saved by that, you know. So I thought that was funny. And then also, a lot of it's about his unfortunate marriage and his wife. And he said, there's a quote, he said, "I hated the woman, but what could I do? I could easily have killed her, but it was always my desire to avoid anything unpleasant." So anyway, and it ends up getting, it's very dark, and he gets kind of, it's a spin out. He spins down. And but anyway, that was really not what we were talking about, but as long as I've decided to intercede with all of that, we're at a point where we can take our break, and then we will come back to the actual story of the development of the book itself. So,
great.
My guests are Mike Hounsky.
Hounsky.
Have I said it wrong now several times, despite the fact that we got that firmed up? This is the thing I've been doing more and more lately. So everybody should just throw tomatoes at me. And Ben Sargent. Tracy, we'll be right back after this. I'm Thorne Dreyer, this is Rag Radio, and we're talking about the discovery and fine printing of O. Henry's lost manuscript, or one of his lost manuscripts, and lost is in quotes because we're not sure how lost it was, but it's definitely been found. My guests are Michael Hounsky and Ben Sargent. Michael is the curator at the O. Henry Museum in Austin, and Ben Sargent is a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist and the illustrator of this wonderful book that they have put together and was actually distributed through the Texas Book Club, I believe. Is that correct?
They're sort of a co-publisher, and we each have our allotment that we're trying to sell, so you can get in touch with me. ohenrymuseum.org. Scroll down.
It's a limited edition of 500, I believe.
Yeah, we right? have the museum has 250 and the Book Club of Texas has 250.
And I have one. I don't know that it's one of the very first, but I grabbed it at the last. And it has this wonderful, elegant inscription by Ben Sargent. And then it has this this lovely squiggle that's just, I mean, that's also very elegant by Mike. So it's great. And this, I assume, is going to make me rich. No, but it's a very cool book, and I would think it's a collectible.
Well, yeah, sure. There's only 250 of them, or 500 of them, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Okay, so, Mike, you were telling us about the evolution of the book, how it came about, and then we're going to talk about the design of the book and how that's put together.
Yeah, so, you know, I basically had these unpublished manuscripts that my previous boss, curator at the O. Henry Museum, gave to me before she left, and said, you know, do something good with them. And I wanted to publish one of them. I freelance on the side. I wrote a story for the New York Times earlier this year on a bookmaker in Wisconsin, Stockholm, Wisconsin, named Gaylord Shanilek. He's known as the preeminent maker of artist books, which are these letterpress books, but have a lot of personalized elements to them and are just a superior quality. They go for $5,000-$7,000, and I saw the art that went into making this book. You know, I had a great story that was unpublished, which was a selling point in and of itself, but I wanted to make a piece of art out of it. So through my connections writing that story and my interest, I was referred to a letterpress printer on the east side of Austin named Bradley Hutchinson, who I came to find out is sort of the dean of letterpress printing here in Austin. And Bradley sort of held my hand through it. You know, I basically transcribed a handwritten manuscript, made a couple decisions on some tricky words, and Bradley put it all together, enlisted Ben Sargent in the project, and we sort of went from there.
And Ben Sargent, who is at the other microphone over here, has been a printer since you were 12 years old?
Yes,
is
sir.
Is that right? and that's... So you're steeped in the grand tradition.
I am, yes. My father taught me letterpress when I was a boy, and I have always been interested in it. Have done it when I've had the opportunity, and since I left the newspaper, I have had a very active letterpress shop, and Austin has a very active and growing letterpress community of letterpress printers, and as Michael said, Bradley Hutchinson at Digital Letterpress is we all consider sort of the dean of the letterpress community here in
and I understand Austin. That you have a 1905 Chandler and Price job press and more than 230 fonts of handset type.
I do indeed.
So I think that's I love it. That's interesting that there's that growing community of printers, of serious mm-hmm. printers, of printers who do fine work. And it's at a time when everybody thinks print is going out of style. You know, I mean, as the digital age comes in and people read on little devices, which are not good for your brain, by the way, not good for your eyes. And you don't comprehend stuff. This is my little editorial.
Yeah.
You don't comprehend as well when you're reading in you know, digitally. But suddenly, you know, there's a sort of community, there's more book collectors, there's a community of people devoted to retaining that tradition, right? So.
Yeah, sort of the book arts is what I think it's kind of collectively known as. And maybe, Ben, you could sort of put into context what it means, letterpress printing, and, you know, going back to Gutenberg.
Well,
and,
yeah, letterpress, when you say letterpress printing, that's printing where the printing is done by a raised surface of type or a plate or something, and an inked surface and prints on the paper.
Not a photographic plate.
It's not photographic like the offset process, or increasingly a lot more and more printing is done by digital processes.
Right.
But letterpress is the original printing process that was the only printing process from the time of Gutenberg in the mid 15th century until the mid 20th century. So,
and the Gutenberg, of course, was, you know, started an incredible revolution. Although
Absolutely.
The difference between, say, that revolution and the digital revolution that the computers have, mm-hmm. is that things happen so quickly now. I mean, you know, it was a long time where it was still there was. People were printing, but it was like monks sitting around reading these, you know, these volumes in cloistered situations. And so it was a long time before it had, its impact was slow and much slower than now we just...
But the impact of the printed book was huge on European and world history. I mean, suddenly a person could there were more books than one person could read in his whole life, and that must have been just sort of stunning to people in the 15th century.
So I
think it probably was similar to sort of the way we feel about the digital revolution.
Right.
It's like.
Right.
Where is it going and all that stuff.
And, you know, I have been a bookseller at times, and it's now there's more versions and editions of just one book, you know, and various printing stuff than a person could read in a lifetime sometimes. I mean, it's just amazing when you see the stuff come in and all different. So it's a wonderful art. It's not going to go anywhere. Although a lot of bookstores are going out of business.
I think it's just sort of a natural reaction to the, you know, everybody's doing digital, so I want to go against the...
Against the grain. So, yeah. Okay, so the book was authenticated.
Correct.
And you did that a lot. I should mention, too, that when we talk about the design of the book, the original, the cover, the front and back cover are... imprinted with the beginning, the actual handwritten script in O. Henry's hand, and I've never seen this. I'm sure maybe it's been done before, but it's certainly not something I remember having seen. And it's beautiful, partly because he wrote. I mean, you could just read this. Forget all the printing.
He had a really good handwriting.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Which is fortunate.
As others see it, by Del Oliver, statement of Winthrop Guest. I desire it to be known that I loathe and abhor a drunk, and I have the utmost contempt for a man who, by indulging to excess in strong drink, degrades and debases himself so far. How could that not be O. Henry's writing? Anyway, I digress.
This particular manuscript was a handwritten manuscript, and I think it maybe was like 25 pages. It's cursive, and you won't find a blemish really on the pages. And I think that what they did was wrote a page until they got it perfect for a sort of a publication purpose. But for the way we made this book, we transcribed it. So when you're reading it text like you would in any other book. But the front cover is the first page of the handwritten manuscript, and the back cover is the last page of the manuscript, and you can see his writing. And if you come to the O. Henry Museum, you can see the entire the actual manuscript.
The title comes from a Robert Burns poem. Is this right?
This is Ben's part. He knows this better than
tell
I
us.
Context better
tell
than
us.
I do.
And I won't try reading it.
Ben
in a
and
Scottish...
Bradley told me so.
I won't try reading it in a Scottish. I had thought that I might, but it's wonderful. So
yeah, it's
tell
a
us.
Famous line from a poem by Burns, the national poet of Scotland, called "To a Louse," and it's "Wad some power the gitty gie us to see ourselves as others see us."
Yeah, I couldn't have even touched that. and how does that relate to the story? As others see us. Well, that's...
Well, the line, Burns' line, is how fortunate we would be if we could see ourselves as other people see us. And so the theme of the story is sort of Winthrop Guest's self-delusion and how he cannot see himself as others see him. And the other half of the story is the testimony of his wife's brother, who tells us his impression of Winthrop Guest, of the main character. And so it's an exploration of that idea of what if we could step back and see ourselves as others see us.
Yeah, and it's also the fact that in the beginning, he thinks that others see him in a way that he doesn't.
Exactly. He's deluded not only about himself, but about other people's perceptions of him.
Right.
Well, he thinks he is an artist in drinking, and he's pulling one over on everyone, but really everyone's in on the game, and they're all wondering, they all see how badly he is unraveling.
Yeah. Maybe at the very beginning he's able to pull it off. but he unravels, and it is a story of unraveling. How many of his stories did not have some kind of ironic twist?
I'm sure there are some out there, but it was a pretty common thing. And, you know, it's one of those deals, I kind of say, he can paint himself into a corner sometimes. You know, the twist either works really well or it works poorly, and you're, as a reader, sitting there waiting for how he's going to tie it together, and you go, eh, wah, wah. Yeah. But when it works, like Gifts of the Magi, I mean, you've got a classic of American literature that everyone's heard of, so.
Right.
But he used to publish stories in the New York World newspaper when he lived in New York. He did a story a week for about 2.5 years, so people eagerly awaited this thing. I equate it to like the Little Orphan Annie radio show on A Christmas Story, the movie. They're all like, oh, you know, the show's on, everyone gather around. I mean, they were ready for the next dose of O. Henry.
Was one of the theories that there was something autobiographical about this book, and that was maybe one reason that it, well, one, that he used the different pseudonym?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the big speculation is, why is this why does he use the Del Oliver byline? And you look at the handwriting and everything, and all the elements of something that is got his O. Henry byline are they're similar and everything. So we know it's a true thing, but my personal speculation is that it ended up, after writing it, maybe felt that it was too autobiographical and maybe made him look like a bad guy, you know, sort of parallel to this unraveling of this drunk story. And O. Henry died partly of cirrhosis, so, you know, you can connect the dots there. He had married a second time a couple years before he died, and it was to his childhood friend, and they weren't living together the whole time. She was still down in Asheville, North Carolina. He was in New York, and you maybe wonder, did Winthrop Guest, who was treating his wife really poorly in this story as he's unraveling as an alcoholic.
And he portrays her as, he married below his station, as it were, and he portrays her as a real kind of harpy or whatever, and we wonder whose perception is correct.
So,
there,
you know, it might have been an afterthought after it was written, going, you know, I'm not really comfortable with that. But it's just so hard to say. You know, these stories turn up and people try to draw their conclusions. We did our research. We weren't able to really find a year when we thought it was written. But if you've read enough stories, you know that it's a really fully formed, mature story written by a guy who knows what he's doing. So we'd like to believe that it was written later in life. So,
okay. Tell us about the book itself. How you decided, and Ben especially, how it was decided to, you know, how you put it all together, because there's a lot of components. There's a lot that went in to making this little, it's a thin volume. I noticed, by the way, there aren't page numbers. Now, is that a tradition? Is that, what's the reason for there not being page numbers?
I think maybe in this case it was just because there weren't a ton of pages.
Not that many pages.
But yeah, you know, I mean, Ben can probably speak a little more to.
Book.
Yeah. There are in fine press books like this. There's sort of a certain template. You have your afterword or foreword. You have that sort of intro part where it's about O. Henry, about the Book Club of Texas, and so you know, Ben and Bradley worked a lot on those production decisions.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tell us what went into determining how this book was going to be designed and produced.
Bradley, who would be here, but he's notoriously shy about this sort of thing, was really the driving force on the design of the book, and everybody involved in the project is very fortunate to have had him do that, because he is such a master and such an artist and has such a good eye for this sort of thing and so much experience with fine printing books. And
he just got a call on his cell phone, I think.
Yeah, from Bradley, probably.
Yeah.
So he designed the layout of the book and sort of the format of it, and picked the typeface for the text and for the headings. It was interesting that the text is interesting to people if they're interested in letterpress, because it's sort of a current thing in letterpress, sort of where 19th century meets the 21st century is digital printing plates, which are letterpress printing plates, but they are made of photopolymer material, and they're made from any digital file that you can come up with. So which is very nice, because a designer can give you any kind of design they want, and you can make letterpress plates out of it and then print in the old-fashioned way. So that the text Bradley set digitally and made into plates. He makes his own plates. It's a typeface called 12-point Benny Old Style, which is Bradley admits is not all that lovely a face, but he felt as though it were it was a face from that era when the story was presumably written. And then we picked the chapter headings, and the title of the book were handset type from my shop that we set, and it's a text face, a lot of people call an old English face, called a cloister black, and so those are handset. And then the whole book was printed at Bradley's shop. He has a couple of beautiful Heidelberg flatbed book presses that he ran all the pages on. I did the illustrations, as you know, and then those were made into polymer plates and printed. And each separate element there, the text, the illustrations, the headings, which are in a different color, were all on separate press runs.
So. I have to say that the illustrations are wonderful
and
incredibly appropriate, and the entire design of the book is just lovely, and it sort of captures a bit of a period sense, although you know it's done it's the technique is obviously sophisticated and probably
right.
More so. I remember at the presentation at the Texas Book Festival, you talked about things like. As I remember, on the title page where you have this information set inside a mirror, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. It's very, very nicely done. A Ben Sargent mirror. It's how Ben Sargent sees himself is through this mirror. and the title, As Others See Us, I remember you said that you didn't have, there wasn't this typeface.
I decided that particular size of cloister black was what was appropriate for that thing, I didn't have it in my shop, and so he called up a friend of his out at the McKenzie and Harris type foundry in San Francisco, who owed him a favor, and the guy said, "Oh, all right, I'll set up that one line for you and send it to you." So he sent it to him. So and when he gave me my type back, and I was distributing the type back into the cases, I came to that, and I thought, where did this come from? I don't have any 36-point cloister black, but now I have one line of it.
And it's not like, you know, online where you can just blow it up.
That's right.
You know, you can just say, we'll take that. And okay, we need to take another break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guests are Michael Hoinski and Ben Sargent. We'll be right back. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. We're back with Michael Hawinski and Ben Sargent talking about the discovery and fine printing of O. Henry's lost manuscript, or at least that's how I put it as a grabber. So I wanted to, Tracy Schultz, tell us about the music we've
been listening to. Yeah, I just wanted to take a moment and give thanks to Howard Raines, who's not here. It's like who performed both of those pieces. It's like our guest here suggested them. They're like two of the potential O. Henry performed pieces. It's like from his time period.
Something that he could have done.
Something he could have done. And it kind of referred to what we talked at the top of the show.
It could have happened. So, yeah.
Well, Howard has deep roots in Texas and, you know, looked at some older tunes that he had that he thought might have been parlor-style tunes that O. Henry's quartet played, and so he reimagined them.
Yeah, I think that's very neat.
Very well done. Great recordings of those as well.
Right, and thank you, Tracy, for getting those up for us, for punching them in.
Okay. Very apropos.
Okay, Michael, why don't you tell us just a little bit more about the process. Tell us about the Texas Book Club.
Well, one of the ideas that Bradley Hutchinson, the letterpress printer, had was to publish this in partnership with the Book Club of Texas, which I didn't know about and I wasn't really into because I didn't want anyone else to have anyone else to benefit from my own thing. I wanted to keep it all to the museum and not have an outside organization, you know, get credit. But the more I realized that it was a necessity for funding, but the more I researched the Book Club of Texas, the more I realized what a prestigious organization it is. It was started in the 1920s by Stanley Marcus, who I believe went to Harvard and got real interested in the book arts and eventually, as you know, started Neiman Marcus.
But he was also a big patron of the arts of all sorts.
Indeed.
You know, and not just a patron as some are who just have lots of money, but I mean, he loved the arts.
I think he actually published Kennedy's speech that he never delivered. That was one of the projects that he did in 63. In any case, the Book Club of Texas was an organization that he started, and it was a slightly different book club. You know, basically members are people that say, once you publish a book, a quality craft book, we'll buy that book. And so you kind of have the built-in order system. But it's an organization that's bounced around since the 20s and now is operated out of the de Gaulle Year Library at Southern Methodist University. And so, as I mentioned earlier, they have 250 copies of this book to sell, and we have 250 here at the O. Henry Museum.
By the way, people can reach, is there a website that people can go to?
Yeah, if you're interested, we're open noon to 5, Wednesday through Sunday.
To those of you in Austin.
Free museum. You can come in and check it out. Also, you can go to ohenrymuseum.org, ohenrymuseum.org. Scroll to the bottom. You'll see where you can email me, Michael Hawinski, and we'll make it happen.
And that's O. Henry, not O. H. Henry.
Correct. He's not Irish. It was. There's no.
Well, I meant not apostrophe. Yeah. Wasn't there a candy bar, O. Henry?
Was that's it the H? O. H.
Yes, that's what I said. It's not that.
Yeah.
So that's where people decide. You know, it's the popular. You know, when somebody makes a candy bar, then they assume that that's the way the name is. O. Henry. But go ahead.
But you haven't asked me the main one. Where did he get the O. Henry pen name?
Where did he get the O. Henry pen name?
I don't really know.
All right.
No, there are a couple of theories. The great thing about O. Henry is when you come to the museum, it's real hard separating the fact from fiction, this guy's story. He's kind of a legendary figure. And O. Henry, a couple possibilities. He went to the Ohio Penitentiary. We thought it might have been an anagram of that. Two other theories are he had a cat named Henry or his favorite bartender was Henry. So it was, oh, Henry, oh, Henry, come here.
Or else all the women would say, oh, Henry.
Oh, Henry. another popular one is that there was a prison guard named Orrin Henry. Might have taken it from that. There was also a chemist named Etienne Ossian Henry. O. Henry was a registered pharmacist from his days in North Carolina at his uncle's pharmacy. So might have stolen it from there. But another theory is that he said O was the easiest letter to write. So he didn't do any. He only did one interview that we know of. He was kind of a reclusive guy, and so you got to interpret stuff the best you can.
By the way, I wanted to mention that if people should go to the Wikipedia article, only because they have some cool pictures. And there's one picture. It's the cut line is Porter in Austin as a young man, and he's and of course he had this wonderful mustache and the hat, and he's holding this umbrella, and it's a great picture.
Yeah, I think he and his wife Athel, when they lived here, they performed in the Gilbert and Sullivan Society, and I think that's a performance shot.
Oh, that's what it looks like. Up. That makes sense.
Oh wow,
that makes sense. Yes, especially since there's a set piece in the background now that I noticed. But they don't mention that in the cut line, and here I'm off mic again. And then there's a picture of him as a clerk, as a criminal slash clerk,
sure,
at the First National Bank of Austin. So, and you know, there's incredible literary traditions in Austin, but this is another in Texas in general. This is another. I mean, much of what he was developing. I mean, then he spent many years in New York, but much of what he was as a writer, he really developed during his period.
And though he's known as a New York writer, he wrote some of the earliest known Western stories based on his experiences here. He actually invented the Cisco Kid, a very famous character in pop culture who's taken on many different permutations. That character appeared in a story, 1907, The Caballero's Way.
So, wow.
And he wrote a lot for kids. You wrote a lot of kids' books, too.
And there's a pun competition, the O. Henry pun competition?
Yeah, the O. Henry Pun-Off takes place every May, I think it's May 7th or 8th, that first Saturday of this year. Been going on 38, 39 years. A wordplay competition, one of the last true, funky, weird, old-school Austin festivals. So you definitely want to check it out. It's free. We do everything for free. we're throwing culture at you.
I have to tell you, a friend of mine has urged me for the last couple of years to go participate, but there was at one point in my life when my mind was reasonably sharp where my father, especially my father, who was a writer and a short story writer of some note, he and I would just sit at the time, people would just, their jaws would drop. We'd just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth with puns and wordplay and stuff. But now
Gary Halleck still in charge of that.
Gary Halleck has done that for 25 years. I believe this last year was his last
one. If we put Gary onto Thorne, he'll never turn loose of it. Gary's Gary's nature.
And keep on the lookout, because we're next fall, we're looking to do a 40th anniversary pun-off exhibit at the O. Henry, so...
Okay,
that'll be a big deal.
Okay, for all of you punsters out there, you guys, a minute about you personally. You, Mike, you're working with. You write about Texas in national publications.
I do some freelancing. I do a regular Friday column for Texas Monthly's website called the Drop Everything List. It's sort of features popular events around the state, and do some other stories when I can find the time. So
that's what I did in the very, very early days. I coordinated this was more the listings kind of stuff, but
yeah.
I coordinated those and did and wrote some stuff back in the early 70s,
sure.
Texas Monthly issue, but it's probably not the same thing. But you write for other publications.
Yeah,
you consider yourself a freelance journalist
sure.
In addition to being a curator.
Museum's a full-time job, so, you know, yeah. I got a 5-year-old child, a wife, you know, freelancing.
And they pay money.
Yeah, so, you know, there's only so much you can do, right?
Yeah. Ben, the world of political cartooning is just it's just amazing. It's astounding. Political cartoonists have often throughout history been incredibly powerful figures. I mean, often more powerful than writers. Have you in the years that, I mean, I'm sure you have some wonderful stories, but have there been times when you've caricatured somebody and gotten them upset and they've come after you or anything like that? Have you had any interesting...
Well, they haven't come after me. I'm sure I upset
maybe in their
a lot
heads
of people.
They have.
Yeah.
Have you, are there any cartoons that you especially, you know, that were...
I think over those years I was at the Statesman, I think we figured I did about 8,000 cartoons. So it's kind of hard to pick one or two.
yeah. But I mean, it's...
But I know we certainly got lots of public reaction and you know, to me, that's what it was all about. It's kind of stirring up the pot of democracy and of public comment.
But it's a very specialized art.
Political
cartoon.
It is indeed. I mean, you need to be able to draw well enough that people can tell what it's supposed to be when it's printed in the paper.
Well, there's that.
And you need to have have sort of an obsessive interest in politics and policy.
Are you a political junkie anyway?
Oh yeah, and to be a political junkie, and then the real key element is to be a smart aleck and to be the kid that was the smart ass in school
But you can be all of those things and not have that skill at doing one frame,
yeah,
and making it communicate some larger political truth.
Yeah.
And that's what astounds me. That's what fascinates me is that ability.
Yeah.
So
well, there are many very talented people still doing it, and even though there are fewer and fewer regular, the classic mold of the full-time staff cartoonists, there are fewer and fewer of those, but there's lots of exciting work that's being done online and in alternate publications. And
yeah, there's some great online cartoonists.
It is an art form that can't be kept down very readily.
No. Who do you admire the most in the field?
Oh, goodness. You mean that's working now or?
Or traditionally.
Well,
Who did you draw inspiration from when you got?
Oh, goodness. I guess there were so many great cartoonists, some of whom I knew, like Jeff McNelly, Bill Malden, people of that nature, and Paul Conrad, Pat Oliphant.
These were the
real giants of the time when I was first coming into the trade, and they did so. And Herblock, of course, was at his drawing board at the Washington Post for like 70 years, was sort of the godfather of us all. So.
Yeah, really. He was there from before he was born, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, is there a collection of your work from your political cartoons?
There was a couple of books we did back in the early 80s with Texas Monthly Press, back when they had a book publishing operation, and there really hasn't been one since then. We had a book called Texas Statehouse Blues in 1980 and one called Big Brother Blues in 1984, and we haven't really done one since. I guess... we ever get the energy to sit down and cook one up. All of my cartoons that I did for The Statesman are now over at the Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas. So
we've
got them all boxed up over there. So
something to research.
But it seems like there's a book you need to do because you've done such beautiful work.
Well, thanks.
And I do want to say that it's not everybody who can do political cartoons and who can also do illustrations. I mean, they're slightly different art forms, mm-hmm. and the work in this book is just beautiful, and yet it's clearly Ben Sargent cartooning. You know, at the same time as being so, I want to admire you, and this is wonderful work. I think this book is great. I think the work that you're doing at the O. Henry Museum, Mike, is terrific. And what's the next book going to be?
Well, we'll go back and revisit the manuscripts and see if there's another one worthwhile. But I need you, in the meantime, people to come buy this one so I can pay to do the next one.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Michael Hawinski and Ben Sargent. And we've been talking about O. Henry's lost manuscript, and I noticed you put "lost" in quotes because it's a little more complex. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not like it was, but
mysterious.
So, but it's a great book as others see it, and you can get it through the O. Henry Museum. Tracy, thank you so much. I do want to say that what we next week, public radio legend Maria Amelia Martin, who among many other things founded Latino USA, and has just an amazing history. She was honored at the University of Texas in an event yesterday for her 40 years in public radio. Then in December, we've got former Yippie activist, author, poet, critic, Jonah Raskin is going to be back.
Nice.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.